even by a god.
The Greeks had one rather democratic thought about their way of philosophy, namely that their deities were never impervious to the consequences of their own misdeeds. The deity was not a privileged being. It was privileged to lead because it possessed certain powers of leadership. But in all its weaknesses, it was punished for these weaknesses. And in this punishment, we find the ancient pattern of society rather carefully maintained. Among the other deities that come into our consideration, therefore, we should consider the monads, or principles, or powers, represented by the 12 laws that the Greeks had perceived or had dimly sensed to be somewhere within the nature of things. Over the physical life and light of nature, they placed the power of the sun. They made Apollo the common sign of light. And they placed in Apollo the conflict between light and darkness in all of its forms. Therefore, while it was a solar deity, it was also the symbol of a strange, polarized nature. For in the case of Apollo, we had this deity under the law of day and night, under the law of darkness and light. We also had Apollo as the slayer of Python, and the Pythian oracles at Delphi, in which the god Apollo spoke in an oracular manner, in hexameter verse, through his entranced priestess. Apollo was therefore more than merely a sun god. He was also a god of harmony, usually the leader of the muses, and represented quite often seated playing upon a lute, surrounded by the attendant muses that form the ceremonial body attached to his own nature. The muses also have their parts to play in things, because the muses represent the breaking up or interpretation of these art instincts into their various specified attributes. Apollo, then, as a principle of light and as the fountain of harmony, has to present both the unbalance arising from conflict, as in the case of overcoming the Pythian serpent, but he also has to be the reconciler and coordinator of all differences and confusions. Thus the Greeks give him the triple title of light keeper. He is not only the visible light carried across the sky in his chariot. He is the invisible light. He is not only the most brilliant thing seen to man, but he keeps the light of Olympus. Without him, the Olympian gods would be in darkness also, which means that consciousness, intellect, and the soul's powers, the vivific forces of nature, are also dependent upon Apollo and the apollonical nature over which he presides. Therefore, light symbolizes the inevitable search for light. It symbolizes truth as being the light of the inner life. It means the importance of man's internal development of the power to see and to know and to overcome the darkness of nature and matter. If, therefore, we are to understand the principle over which Apollo leads, we could say that he is the leader of the urge or the pressure that draws men to the light. He is the peculiar custodian of truth, the search for which is perhaps man's greatest adventure, regardless of what he calls the various processes of living. He is therefore a kind of psychopompus of the mysteries and plays a very important part in almost all of the rituals. In coming to the deity Ars or Mars, we come into the presence not necessarily of a war deity, although in the course of time the war principle began to develop. But namely that in Mars is the potential father fountain of activity, the dynamic, the pressing on, the forcefulness of human character. Consciousness, represented by Zeus, becoming dynamic, takes upon itself the appearance of Mars. And in the form of Mars, it pursues a certain course and purpose. In other words, it aspires or achieves to ambition. It directs itself to the fulfillment of a particular task by means of the expenditure of energy. Mars, therefore, represents the struggle, the striving of consciousness to attain dominance over ignorance. It is the battle between the unknown and the truth seeker. It is also the struggle between the inadequacy in the individual and the ultimate goal. It perhaps is a little reminding of the rather contradictory concept of the old Christian hymn, Onward Christian Soldiers. The idea of the servants of Christ being soldiers is not exactly in the pure spirit of Christian pacifism, but it still represents the idea that the attainment of the Christian purpose must be by a dynamic. The individual must be a dedicated soldier in the sense that he is part of a body of persons consecrated to the overcoming of evil and the victory of good over evil. It is a kind of crusade, and this crusade of life is under the control of Mars. And when this crusade becomes unbalanced or destructive, we then find Mars emerging as a combative principle. The deity Vesta has always seemed to me to be particularly interesting, because she represents not only the idea of spiritual virginity, but she goes into the true meaning of that, inasmuch as it represents the old priestess veiled with her ancient garment of wool, seated in an aloof place, entirely absorbed in her own internal meditation. Vesta, therefore, represents the internal life. It represents the individual departing not only from the corruption of the world, but from the worldliness of the world. Perhaps religious orders, of which the Vestal Virgins were one of the earliest to be recorded, this retreat away from worldliness was only a symbol of the search for esoteric integration within the self. It was the person in the quiet contemplation of their own divinity. It was the individual seeking to attain union with truth. Therefore, Vesta represents the secret ways of things, where through by purity, renunciation, discipline, and detachment, the consciousness is freed from the limitations of error and remains strangely calm, strangely aloof, strangely impersonal, and therefore is able to escape from error. This, I think, is one of the reasons why this deity is so associated in the mystery cults of the ancient Greeks and Romans. Now we have also one of our best known deities, and that is Mercury or Hermes. Mercury or Hermes was the communicator. In some mysterious way, the revelation of man's fountains of potential finally bring us into the direct presence of the sensory perceptions. And over these perceptions rules the power by means of which all sensory perceptions take from a common fountain or source. There is only one visual energy in nature, regardless of who sees or how much they see. There is one only auditory power in nature. And in certain creatures, this power produces the auditory phenomena. In others, it does not. But there is only one seeing, one hearing, one tasting, one touching. All of these are aspects of a common energy. And this common energy was Mercury or Hermes. For this reason, and because of man's dependence upon the sensory perceptions which he possesses for what he terms knowledge, education, enlightenment, or the advancement of his cultural destiny. Hermes was the instructor, the teacher, the messenger of the gods, the communicator between heaven and earth, and in Egypt under the name of Thoth, the great scribe, or the keeper of all records, supposedly to have been the author of thousands of books, for the reason that the principle gained through observation and reflection over which Mercury rules became in substance the author of all books. All things of an intellectual sensory nature arise from Mercury, which also bears down upon us with the impulse to communicate, so that if we become too loquacious or too easily desirous of sharing either our knowledge or our ignorance, we do so by virtue of the mercurial principle. This tendency to communicate, to share, to seek to escape from isolation into a common comradeship of purposes, all these problems and pressures the Greeks recognized and personified under the nature of the deity Mercury or Hermes. This deity was also regarded as the god of thieves, which is not particularly remarkable, for is not ingenuity the basis of thievery? Is not our knowledge the thing that is making us today perhaps the most corrupt of all peoples? We wonder if that is an exaggeration, but after all, we know that more of our knowledge is used to advance selfish purposes, perhaps at the expense of each other, than is actually expended for common good. Therefore, it is not impossible to conceive that Mercury, by making man smart, also makes it possible for him to be dishonest with a greater measure of efficiency and with greater thoroughness and more profit to himself and greater loss to his victim. In any event, not only in the ancient times, but as late as the Middle Ages, Mercury was worshipped as a deity of thieves and also as the messenger of the gods. The next principle that perhaps we should give a pause to is our old friend Vulcan. Now, Vulcan was the smithy, the Tubal-cain of the ancient Greek pantheon. He was the god of the subterranean fires and things. He was the keeper of the smoldering pressures. And I think that it perhaps would be as well as anything else to suggest that under the heading of Vulcan, we now list those subconscious instincts which more or less occupy our own underworld, which break forward in or into our objective through the great combustions of our emotions, as in our complexes, frustrations, and neuroses. And that by means of these frustrations and by means of the volcanic principle, these pressures create armament and defensive weapons to protect or to arm the various attitudes and principles that we hold on to, so that actually this subconscious is forever arming our objective life against honesty or against the solution of the problems created by the subconscious itself. If it only produces an excuse, there is very little difference between an excuse and a good shield, because they actually represent defensive armament. Anything but admit the fact, escape or evade, or perhaps build subconsciously such heavy patterns of tension and pressure that we can no longer discover our own natures. In any event, not only was Vulcan drawn into these kind of problems, but he also acted as a kind of smithy for the gods. He was the one that was called in on a number of occasions where tasks of unusual nature were required. He likewise had to do with the release of the powers of nature, the secret or hidden powers of nature. And it is quite possible that under Vulcan likewise would belong the entire theory of atomics, because he was the keeper of the secret powers, and he is the one who made the thunderbolts for Zeus. He provided these thunderbolts. And remembering that all of these deities representing embodiments by law, if Zeus or consciousness orders the thunderbolts, then Vulcan, or the natural machinery of life, must produce them. Because all of these deities must obey Zeus, because he is the consciousness by means of which they can fulfill his duties. And as he is consciousness, they have nothing with which to resist him. But if he demands of them that which is unreasonable, he then may cast himself into Tartarus for ages to come. But Vulcan indicates there is a tremendous combustion available, which the gods use for various purposes, and bring a terrible penalty if those purposes be wrong. Now we hear much of the moon deity chase Diana, the great mother of the Ephesians. She was the lunar symbol and principle, and she was called the goddess of the hunt. Now, moon and imagination have always been curiously and wonderfully related together. The moon represents a certain part of man's psychic field. It represents the entire vista of imagination. The moon is the imager. Imagination is this peculiar metaphysical power which, like some sorcerer of old, waves a wand and the appearance of everything changes. Imagination is the very substance of the Midsummer Night's Dream, by which everything is a fantasy. Imagination places man in a world of fantasy, a world which can be a beautiful dream or a terrible dream, according to his ability to direct the power of imagery within his own consciousness. Yet imagery has more to it than merely self-deception or self-satisfaction. Imagination, whether we realize it or not, is the great power beyond progress and behind it. It is because only that we have imagination that we can ever exceed what we are now. Therefore, the lunar deity is forever exceeding itself. It is forever moving from the known toward the unknown through the visualization of imagination. And by believing all things to be possible, the moon makes many new things, not only to be possible, but to be actual. So the goddess firing her arrow at the stag reminds us also of the significance of the stag in alchemy. The stag, or the mysterious unicorn, which is almost identical with it, this timid creature that seeks forever to escape the weapons of the nocturnal huntress, who always hunts in the night, for imagination cannot function where the light of fact is too bright. This capturing of the stag, or the tying of the shawl around the unicorn's horn, is imagination ever striving to grasp pure idea and also to become identical with the substance of intuition. Intuition is the creature that imagination hunts for. It is the science which imagination seeks to discover. But very often, instead of capturing it, it destroys it with its shaft. Diana the Huntress, her symbol in the human consciousness of man's constant visualization of things unknown, also presents a very clear picture of the understanding which the ancients possessed of many of these points. Now, in the old legends and mysteries, Aphrodite, or Venus, was born out of the sea. According to the old legend of Hesiod, she was born out of the great sky ocean of Uranus. But out of other systems, she was the great child of ocean. And she emerged or came forth out of the sea in a magnificent seashell. The story of Venus and her, or Aphrodite, and her place in the great study of philosophy is perhaps most clearly summarized by Plotinus in his essay on the beautiful. Actually, Venus represents the principle of sheer and pure beauty. She is far deeper than the later Romans, with their rather physical and literal inability to detect abstract principles rather more than they could cope with as far as interpretation is concerned. But according to Plotinus in his essay on the beautiful, all things, whatever they may be, are ruled inevitably and eternally by proportion, by the irresistible instinct to be orderly, and by an equally insistent demand to be harmonic, to be gathered together in suitable arrangement. So that things which are by nature deformed or asymmetrical are displeasing to us as adventures of consciousness. Also colors which are inharmonious clash upon our sensitivities. Sounds which are discordant displease us. And within our natures we are forever mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and morally seeking harmony, seeking beauty, seeking the realization that beauty on the level of conduct is morality. Beauty on the level of philosophy is ethics. Beauty on the level of religion is love. All of these principles represent harmony, peace, concord, agreement, consanguinity, instead of division, discord, disruption, death. Man has instinctively realized that there is a peculiar divine nature, and that therefore all things subsist according to beauty in one of its two forms. Now there are two forms, as the Greeks pointed out, the ancient form of beauty born of heaven, and the later form of beauty born of the sea, as Aphrodite. The ancient form of beauty is cosmic concord, or cosmic harmony, the divine order of things. And in the manifestation from heaven itself into the great manifesting abyss of time, eternity moving into time and filling it, stands revealed as a supreme beauty, a perfect order, a mathematical, geometrical, harmonic relationship, symmetrical solids, all things in concord without dissonance or conflict among themselves. This was the ancient or primordial beauty. The secondary beauty born of ocean is that kind of beauty which is born of man's desire for goodness. Good is a kind of beauty. It is a little different in its essence and substance from truth, which is a sovereign beauty. But man, attempting to serve truth, attempts to do so by conducting himself according to the good. Socrates describes the great triad of the one, the beautiful, and the good. The one by which all things are created. The good by which all things are ultimately brought to fruition. And the beautiful by means of which heaven and earth are bound together. And by means of which all things in nature are redeemed. And that by beauty we shall understand the redeeming power of the gods. That all things shall be saved, shall be made new again, shall be restored and rescued. And that beauty shall adorn itself with spring, and come forth after the darkness of winter. Thus all good things, the virtues and graces of man's consciousness, all these things are said to be good, and therefore to be beautiful. And the peculiar abstract archetype of beauty is one of the great fountains of space, from which flow energies under total law. For the law of beauty is as absolute as the law of truth. There is no essential difference in their value, except that by beauty things are persuaded toward reality, and go toward reality joyfully in the great processionals of the mysteries. Thus beauty has a wonderful converting power, and the gods could not join with each other in the sumptuous repasts of Olympus and share in their common duties unless beauty was among them. And the presence of beauty is therefore regarded as essential in all the meetings of the great instruments of state and wisdom. For without beauty, there can be no true justice. Now we can pause again and study this most mysterious, controversial, and difficult of all probably of the Olympian deities, and that is Pallas Athena, or as we call her more commonly, Minerva. Here is the hero goddess maiden. Here is the deity usually depicted in armor, helmed, and bearing a spear, and also often with a shield upon which is the boss of the Gorgon's head. This divinity is a strange, almost androgyne creature, being to some the goddess of wisdom, to others a goddess of war. Among her attributes were those of knowledge and the breaking of wild horses, so that it shows the strange diversity into which the attributes of this deity are recognized. It is said that she was born from the head of Zeus, which broke open to permit her to come forth not only fully developed and full grown, but also wearing her armor and complete as she was to be. Therefore, she is to be understood as the mind-born, the one that is created by will or created by yoga, a creation which becomes practically the symbol of the yogic power of the Greek metaphysics. Minerva, therefore, is a secret art or power, a secret principle or energy made available. And in all principle and substance, I think we may say that she was the embodiment or the personification of the concept of the sacred arts by means of which man became as a god, knowing good and evil. Thus she represents the presence eternally of the doctrine of the mysteries in the Greek way of life. She was the secret school of the wisdom religions. She becomes a symbol also of the extrasensory perceptions of man by means of which this knowledge can be attained or known. Therefore, you might say that as Duke University is believing in the existence of extrasensory perceptions and is trying to classify this phenomenon, that the Greeks would say that if this phenomenon exists, it flows as part of an energy from one of the great sovereign fountains of space. If this is true, in other words, that there is an extrasensory perception, then this belongs to the whole mystery of existence. It is a power really and eternally present, locked within the mystery of things. And Diana, representing imagination or intuition, seeks in the lights and shadows of emotion for this, whereas Minerva, strangely aloof, the symbol of wisdom and the guardian of the great city of Athens, which was regarded as the repository of the glory of Greece. She represents the divine patron of learning. She represents the mysterious armed power that fights in the sky for those that are right. She is peculiarly sympathetic and close to her father, for she is of his mind and substance, having been born without union with any conflict within her own nature. She is not the progeny of conflict. She is born there of a kind of immaculate conception, having no discord or division within herself. Minerva is therefore a very interesting and important symbol, representing the secret knowledge contained within the entire story of the Olympian deities. For she is the key to the cycle and everything that pertains to it, the indication that there is a meaning and a purpose behind this entire pageantry of symbols. With her spear, she reveals much. With her shield, she protects light. With her helm, she defends the source and heart of things. When Orpheus, the great bard of Thrace, is torn to pieces by the Cyclonian women in their orgy in the hills of Thessaly, his body was cast in many pieces into a river, but Minerva, sweeping down, took his head and carried it back to Olympus. Therefore, Minerva becomes, so to say, the defensive administrator of the will of Zeus, And also when Dionysus, the beloved son of Zeus, was torn to pieces by the Titans, it was again Minerva who rescued his immortal part and took it back to heaven. Therefore, Minerva is forever the rescuer of the immortal parts of things, and may well be regarded as the esoteric or secret teaching by means of which the most precious or important parts of things are restored again to the spiritual fountains from which they came. Though we likewise have Ceres, or Demeter, we said that she represented to a degree or in a way the harvests, or the production and protection of life through grain and industry. To the ancient Greek people, I think Ceres or Kore had a meaning, again, relating back to principles. And this principle was that of nutrition. In the great pattern of things, it is the duty of Ceres to remind all things that they must be nourished according to their own natures. Now this is very important, as Taylor points out in his mystical dissertations. If we wish a thing that it shall grow, then we have a law in nature which says that it must grow according to its kind, according to its seasons, and according to its laws, that there must be the necessary seed for the future planting. Therefore, the rise of the idea of tithing, or the putting away of the 10% for the Lord, which symbolizes the putting away of the seed for the coming planting. So, Ceres, representing this principle of nutrition, goes into the philosophy of the Greeks in a very interesting way in your Socratic philosophy. For all things to have their nutrition must be fed of their own substances. If, therefore, man desires beauty, he must feed his beauty with beauty. If he desires wisdom, he must nourish his wisdom from the great fountains of wisdom. If he desires understanding, he must nourish the understanding within himself with a proper food or natural diet. One of the things, for instance, that Corey tells us is that there are no miracles in the nutrition of things. That as the body must have those foods necessary to itself or perish, so the invisible and eternal life of man, including the gods who must have their ambrosia and their nectar, must have a food suitable to their own natures. All things are developed by the strengthening of their own kinds, by the development and recognition of their own principles. We achieve almost any end which we seek by becomingness, by developing within ourselves the similitude of that which we desire. If we wish to have a kindly nature, we must continually cultivate kindliness, nourish ourselves with our own kindly thoughts and actions, and become keenly aware of the value of kindness in our relation with others, and also in the interrelation of peoples of all types and kinds. If we desire to have peace of soul, we must feed peace with peace, for we cannot feed peace with a sword or with discord. And we cannot, as Pythagoras points out, achieve peace by scattering coals with a sword blade. Each thing must be according to its own kind. If we desire unity, we must nourish our lives upon the consciousness of unity. If we desire to dedicate our achievements to some great cause, we must nourish this dedication by action, by consecration, and by the continual restatement of our purpose within ourselves always. And that which we use to nourish us must be like to the thing which we wish to achieve, for we cannot become kindly by allowing ourselves to live on a diet of gossip. We cannot become gentle by allowing ourselves to continually receive into our natures destructive or unkindly sentiments and ideas. So, Demeter or Ceres is the principle of the nourisher, that all things must be nourished by the qualities which we desire them to reveal. And that by continually keeping this rule or this law, we shall achieve a great deal more for ourselves. I just wanted to see whether it missed anybody in this pattern. I don't think we have. The points, therefore, that we want to make are, as Hesiod tells us, that these 12 deities are the fountains of powers. Now, the Greeks were not, as I have said, entirely in agreement as to these powers or to their names. But the principle beneath their concept is always consistent and obvious. And that is that these powers represent like 12 great bowls or fountains flowing continually in the sky. Now, in the Greek theology, for example, the deities, the principal deities, are not in the center of the solar system, but in the circumference. Therefore, the great gods reside in the band of the zodiac, the great medial band of the ancient Egyptian and Greek thinkers. And their forces flow downward and inward, from the circumference to the center, continuously. And in the midst of this entire field is the crater, or cup, into which all of their energies are finally mingled. And out of this cup arises the strange and fantastic form of the genii, or the genius of man, the symbol of the being in whose nature all natures are combined and mingled. For as the myth of Dionysus tells us, in man's nature is the blood of the gods and the ashes of the Titans. Man, as he stands today, therefore epitomizes or receives into himself all of the mystery of the Olympian order, all of the strange cosmogony that has gone before, all the conflict and confusion of fable and legend. All the unfinished business of the ages is vested in man himself. To understand this is to rescue his own relationship with life. Man, looking into himself, has great difficulty in perceiving this. He looks into himself and he sees only mystery. As he looks into himself, he is not even able to be aware of his own inness. He is unable to be consciously conscious of any root or source within his own nature. And because his objective faculties blaze forth out into phenomena, his noumenal or internal causal nature is known only by mathematics, by statistics, by formulas, or by symbols. The ancients, realizing this, knew that man's greatest hope of discovering the innermost nature of his own being was to discover his relationship to the larger world, into which all the elements flowed which made up his own peculiar nature. So they gave us this elaborate creation myth, which can move inside of man and become a symbol of his entire coordinating existence. According to Paracelsus, who was very wise in these things also, man is a constellation consisting of 12 orders of energy, that these orders of energy constitute the great magnetic field in which he functions, that these 12 orders of energies flow in the great field of his auric egg, which is his egg of Hades, and from which bursts also Fades, many-headed and many-armed. The entire story can be taken into the psychological life of the human being. Some time ago, I was talking with quite an expert on the problems of certain psychological, biological phenomena, and they said that they felt quite certain that in the course of time, we would inevitably and properly divide all mental aberration and psychological phenomena into 12 types. And these 12 types would all represent primarily, that is, negative psychological phenomena, would all represent abuses of primordial psychic energy. Well, if there are 12 ways in which primordial psychic energy can be abused, then these abuses would certainly be significant of the rebellion of the Titans, and the fact that these primordial energies were turned against the gods. And at that time, only one energy refused to move, refused to take part in the conspiracy, and that energy was Ocean. That remained patient under all the adversities of this conflict. So that the only energy which did not turn and become involved in this rebellion was the pure energy of energy itself. That is, the life principle. The principle of vitality. Everything else was corrupted. But it remained beyond corruption. And in the development of this corrupting power, the Titans, turning against heaven and earth, launched their terrible war, for which they were ultimately destroyed. And out of the residue and refuse of this tremendous primordial conflict, there gradually emerged the second order of man. In this case, the second order being under the control of the Jupiterian monad, or the power of personal consciousness. Behind personal consciousness was the struggle of the subjective energies of space, as these struggled in the psychic field of man himself. And it was only after, therefore, the destruction of the Titans, or the energies, which were gradually exhausted or brought under control, that Zeus was able to achieve his victory over the Titans and to bind these rebel energies in the mysterious underworld. Now, if we take by this underworld the symbol of the unconscious or subconscious life of man, we know that consciousness, represented by will and action, therefore becomes the conscious ruler of the world. But that against this conscious ruler is the eternal rebellion of the imprisoned Titans in the underworld. And that if for any reason Zeus relinquishes the power of his thunderbolts and the power of his lightning, or loses the skill and keenness of his all-seeing eye, there will immediately be a conflict. The Titans will attempt to destroy and may even endanger the balance of the world. On one occasion, Zeus was confronted with a most unhappy situation. 11 of his own deities rebelled against him. He was threatened with war in heaven. He then proceeded to take his thunderbolt, and he stood upon the edge of his great throne, and he told these deities that if they wished to do so, that they could all revolt and leave him alone, that they could go down into any parts of the world they wanted to and establish their own worlds, their own universes, and that he would then take the entire creation which they had fashioned, circle it with a golden chain, bind it to the pinnacle of Olympus, draw this chain back into heaven, and leave all the gods and godlings swinging in space between sky and earth. It was a big scene, you know. We're not sure that they ever put it on, but it was quite a big scene. But psychologically, here we have this situation. The Titans are not dead. We know that. We know that the titanic, disordered forces of man's life are not dead. That they are controlled by the power of consciousness and reason. That certain faculties, and the ancient Hindus recognizing 12 convolutions of the brain, relate these 12 centers with the 12 principal deities of their great circle of Mount Meru, that there are certain orderly deities or orderly process functions by means of which chaos is prevented from controlling the life of man. That even these faculties may rebel, and that constantly the gods must be alert, as in the case of the Nordic deities, lest the powers of darkness, representing the combustion of the titanic faction, should break through the underworld and attempt to storm the earth and destroy heaven. Thus the Greeks seemed to have a touch of the psychologist in them. They sensed the constant danger of impulse, of negative, unconditioned, uncontrollable anger, passion, hate, fear. These things as primordial forces which have to gradually be brought into a civilized state. In other words, through the regeneration or redemption of the titanic powers. Gradually the good Titans were reformed, but the struggle goes on still to prevent the consciousness of man from being swallowed up in the abyss of chaos as a result of disordered factors taking control over the organized life of the human mind. Thus, the psychological drama is certainly well exemplified and well indicated in the Greek story. Actually, the gods do not seem to be very busy most of the time in the Olympian story. Someone asked the ancient fabulist Aesop what the gods did. And he said the principal activity of the deities was to lift up the small and to cast down the great. And this we see in history to be more or less factual in the development of our great social concepts. But actually the gods are not arbitrators or arbiters of anything, representing energies. They simply fulfill their own natures. These energies are not moral or immoral. They are not good or bad. They are not more or less. These energies are simply the fountains of life potential by which all things exist and are sustained and move toward their various destinies. The Greeks did not believe in good and evil spirits as we do. They believed in nature, in which various uses caused energies to be apparently good or bad, but that an energy was an amoral thing, something that had its own ways, its own purposes, and its own laws. To break the laws of an energy is to come under the retribution of that energy. To keep the laws of an energy means to have continually increasing participation in that energy. Therefore, through obedience, all things are attained. And the problem of balancing and integrating the forces of these patterns constituted the great secret of Greek religion and philosophy. Pythagoras and Plato and Aristotle were well aware of the fact that man having 12 dynamic factors must bring them into order. He must not only use them, he must prevent them from injuring each other in the process of use. He must therefore bind his Olympian deities together into one harmonious body of cooperating powers. And he does this by establishing the sovereignty of reason, by means of which he brings all other things into their proper relationships with each other. Philosophy is this coordinating factor. It is by philosophy that man learns how to unite variables and to bring them into enduring patterns of harmony and mutual reciprocity. It is only by philosophy, therefore, that the individual can learn the significance of intervals. Intervals being the spaces between things. In this case, qualitative intervals. Here we have intuition as a kind of quality. Against intuition, we must balance judgment, another kind of quality. Against intuition and judgment, we must triangulate beauty, the man's aesthetic concept of life. These things must be discovered not to be contradictory in themselves, nor shall they frustrate one another, nor shall the service of one result in the neglect of the other. This means that man has to gradually balance all of these potentials until he lives in a pattern of their common harmonic cooperation. This was the Pythagorean and Platonic concept, that these gods or powers had to come through in man into expression, and that the perfect man, the integrated man, the safe citizen, is the one in whom all functioning powers are so balanced that there can be no conflict within the nature itself. If there is no conflict within a nature, then the conflict between that nature and other natures is also reduced. But the end of the Olympian order, as rising from the titanic chaos, is that from the titanic chaos of ignorance, savagery, and the lack of self-control, man must elevate himself to the Olympian order of cooperation, mutual assistance, understanding, wisdom, knowledge, peace, beauty, and truth. By achieving this empire, this hierarchy of value within himself, the individual achieves the security which he needs for the active participation in his own daily affairs. The Greeks, however, were not the kind of people who would make a tremendous job out of this. The Greek was a happy man. He was not dedicated in the sense of being a martyr. He had no intention of sacrificing everything that was pleasant in life for the cultivation of abstract virtues. But what he tries to tell us, and perhaps he is far righter than we realize, is that the life of penance, the life of spiritual misery, the life of constant unhappiness about values, is not a good life, and not a life intended. That actually, the harmony of these powers is inherent in themselves. Everywhere in space, these powers do get along together, except in man. Therefore, man is the battlefield between the titans and the gods, and it is here that the great Armageddon must be fought. That this conflict is not in nature, not in heaven, not in earth, but in the imperfect nature of man himself. Therefore, that instead of fighting this conflict, the individual has merely to relax into a state of order. It is not that he must do certain things better than he is doing them and other things he should not do. The key to the matter is that he should move directly and simply along the lines of the laws governing energy without self-deceit, without permitting false values to distort him away from the natural honor with which he is endowed. The deities, therefore, will give him their protection and their power. The wisdom of Pallas Athena is his, and she fights in the sky above him, as long as he preserves the simple, direct search for wisdom, a search which is not for a particular wisdom, that one shall know more of this or more of that, but the kind of wisdom that has the instinctive ability to discover the beautiful and the good in all things. A natural, simple relaxation away from excess. When man no longer is a victim of excess, that which remains is moderation. And all of the heavenly mysteries are linked in moderation. For in moderation, all things can be used, but in excess, all things damage each other. So the struggle for the Olympian order in man to the Greeks was the bringing of order in his thinking, in his living, in his relationships with others. And that through this Olympian order, as Plato points out, there will ultimately emerge the government of the world. For the government of the world is nothing more or less than universal government applied to the establishments of men. And until men reverence universal government in their own personal living, they will not support it in their community functions. So this pattern becomes the basis of all relationships and all laws. And next week we'll go on with some more of it, but it looks like the time is up for this evening.